Hello and welcome to the Health Report with me, Norman Swan. Today, seeing sounds, hearing colours, and words which give you a bad taste. Astounding findings about how our brains develop and the adults who may have retained more plasticity in their brains than others. Also, juggling in your brain, video games to help some people see better, electrical stimulation that might speed stroke recovery, and lots more, including whether a sense of morality is hardwired into us. Are we born good? And are we born with a belief about what's good and bad? Fascinating research with babies in Canada is suggesting that even very young infants can make quite sophisticated moral and perhaps even legal judgments. Kylie Hamlin is in the Department of Psychology at the University of British Columbia.
I'm interested in our moral sense as adults, how we know what things are good and bad and what things are right and wrong, and which individuals are the good guys and which are the bad guys. And I'm interested in how this comes to happen in adults. We know that most adults very clearly know that hitting is wrong and giving to charity is good, but we don't necessarily know how they came about that knowledge. And what I've been doing is asking that question in babies before they can speak, before they've been to school, before their parents have really taught them much about what's good and bad, and ask whether, even though they haven't really been taught this stuff, whether they already know.
How'd you do that?
Well, basically we show them these little puppet shows in which there's good puppets and bad puppets.
Live puppet shows.
Yeah, we have a bunch of puppeteers who are putting these shows on for babies, and there's a puppet who has some goal that it can't achieve. So say to get to the top of a hill, or to open a box, or to get his ball back that he dropped.
So a very simple story.
Right, totally simple. And the babies see two additional puppets, one of whom is always helpful to the character, so maybe pushes him up the hill, or gives him his ball back, or opens the box for him.
Are they being verbal?
Nope, they're just doing this with their actions. So there's no sounds at all, except maybe when the box gets shut, you can hear that happening. So the mean puppets are hitting the guy down the hill or slamming the box closed or taking the ball away. And so we show them these a number of times until they get what we call habituated to the event, until they get bored with it.
Just to make sure they've taken it in.
Exactly. With little babies, you often will make sure they've gotten everything they're going to get out of it by showing them the same thing over and over again. Because once they don't want to look anymore, it suggests they just don't need any more information. And then we simply have them choose between the helpful puppets and the unhelpful puppets. And we find a huge number of babies, almost every single baby we ever tested, have liked the nice puppets over the mean puppets.
How do you know they like it?
Basically, the most basic way to ask is just which one do they want to touch? If they are given the two puppets sort of equally far from their hands, we just see which one they touch first.
What about babies that aren't even sitting up yet and don't reach very much at all?
Right. Before about 4.5 months of age, babies don't yet reach out for objects in the world. Sometimes they flap their arms toward objects in the world. Sometimes they try to eat it or stuff like that, but they're not good reachers yet. And those babies, we hold the puppets just up in front of their faces for 30 seconds and just measure the amount of seconds that they look at the nice puppet versus the mean puppet. And we find basically exactly the same pattern of results. So even 3-month-olds look longer at nice, helpful puppets than they do at mean, unhelpful puppets.
Do you control for things like whether or not the children have seen television? They've been acclimatized to some of this stuff because they've been parked in front of a television set?
We don't specifically ask things like that. One thing that we haven't found is differences in children that have siblings versus don't have siblings, and that you might expect that the experience...
The evil brother versus the nice sister.
Right. But basically, a baby as young as 3 months really isn't able to focus on a television screen yet at that point, so we doubt that they're getting much out of it.
And you've also looked at punishment.
Yeah, so of course, as adults, we know that good is good, right? Being helpful is good, except there are certain situations in which we think maybe being mean is better. So in the case in which someone deserves punishment.
You're being mean to somebody because they've been bad.
Yeah, so in some ways, it's good to be bad when someone deserves it. So we've shown babies shows in which they are seeing someone be nice and someone be mean to a target, but he himself has been bad before.
They're asking the baby, do they deserve it?
That's the idea, yeah. So we're trying to ask them, given the choice of someone who was nice to a bad guy or someone who was mean to a bad guy, which one do you prefer? And we thought at first when we started running this study that what would happen is that they might be confused. Either they might like niceness across the board or they might get confused. And it turns out they're not confused at all. They really like the guys who are mean to the bad guy. And interestingly and importantly, they don't like it when you're mean to somebody who somebody else was mean to. So it doesn't seem like they're just matching negative for negative. They actually do.
They make their own judgment.
It seems like they're really saying, no, it's good to be bad to somebody who was bad to someone else. It's not good to be bad to somebody who just happens to have been negative or something like that. It really has
Crime
to
and Punishment at 4 months of age.
Yeah, so those are 8-month-olds, but pretty much, yeah.
That's incredible. And how do you assess their approval or disapproval of punishment?
It's exactly the same way. We always really look at who do they choose first. So this very basic preference. And in the punishment case, first they see a puppet show where one guy's good and one guy's bad. And then they see a second puppet show with a different scenario altogether in which either the good guy from the first show or the bad guy from the first show is now the guy who, say, lost his ball and needs his ball back. And so we ask whether, if it's a bad guy, do they think it's better to give the ball back or take the ball away? And it turns out they think it's better to take the ball away from the bad guy.
And how many times do they have to see it now? Because you're originally habituating them, but you don't do that anymore.
Right. It turns out that they don't need to be habituated to these shows to get this. So in this particular punishment study I just described, there are 5 characters. So they see a puppet show in the beginning with 3 characters, a good guy and a bad guy. And then they see one of those characters go into the second puppet show with a good guy and a bad guy. But it turns out that we only have to show them each thing one time for them to even get this complex thing like punishment. So it's pretty incredible how tuned into this they are.
Mind-bogglingly, I can't imagine how you've possibly done it. You've studied intent.
Right. Intent is, of course, something that, if you think about legal systems, is 9/10 of the issue. So you're still bad if you try to kill someone and don't. And if you accidentally harming someone is almost never going to get you jail time or whatever. But in the past, studies have shown that kids are really bad at understanding intention in these ways. So kids will say that Jimmy, who accidentally broke a whole bunch of teacups, deserves punishment, whereas Johnny, who only broke 1 teacup but did it on purpose, deserves less punishment. Obviously the opposite of what an adult would say. But we thought maybe these puppet show tasks are easier for kids to understand than are these long verbal stories. So we just showed them a character who tries to help but fails, tries to help a character get a box open and they fail together. So the box doesn't get open, the guy doesn't get his toy or whatever, versus a guy who tries to harm but fails. So he tries to block the character from getting the box open, but he gets it open anyway. And it turns out that when we pit those outcome versus intentions against each other, babies go with intention. So they actually prefer a guy who tries to help but leads to a bad outcome versus a guy who tries to harm. They're going with the mental states of the puppets, in as much as puppets can have mental states, as opposed to the outcome of the bad thing.
So if it's happening in almost every baby that you test, this has to be hardwired.
That's the theory. Either it's hardwired as in present at birth, or it's hardwired as in there's some kind of learning mechanism, some kind of way in which babies come to the world ready to learn that this is the important stuff. Scientists talk about one trial learning. Things that are really important to us as humans, we might learn incredibly quickly. So it might be the case that babies are having some experience that's turning this on, but it's turning it on really early and for every baby we test.
And have you tested babies across the environmental spectrum from all sorts of backgrounds?
What you will often find is that you get a pretty narrow range of folks in your study. You know, we get a fairly biased sample, which is parents who are willing and able to take time out of their day to come and help us out with our studies. That said, we do have a spectrum, and the fact that we get so little variation in the babies that we do see suggests that that's not influencing anything. Of course, it would be critically important to study these same questions in lots of different cultures in order to make sure that's still happening. But one of the things about why we study babies is that they have less influence of culture than human adults do, simply because they haven't been in the culture that long.
So the religious notion that babies are born good is right.
You know, I like to point out the distinction between being good and thinking that others should be good. As adults, of course, we often do things that we would judge other people very negatively for doing themselves. What our research shows, I think, is that babies are inherently judgmental and they think that there's good stuff and bad stuff and good guys and bad guys. Whether they themselves are good is a separate and really interesting research question. I have some work on that, asking whether babies enjoy being helpful. And others have found that very young toddlers, so basically by the time that they are physically capable of doing so, babies will stand up and go help someone get their goal. So it does seem like through this other research that maybe they are sort of born good. But I would say that this particular research is more about judging other people as being good.
But of course, if these things are hardwired, you've got to do quite a lot to them in the environment to change that behavior. And of course, many people's behavior is changed through life.
That's another point about the relationship between judgment and behavior. Probably everybody, even those who do bad things, can tell that hitting somebody isn't good. They still do it, but they can tell it's bad. And if another person did it, they wouldn't like that person. So it might be that there's less variability in how we're able to judge others than there is in what
controlling
we do ourselves.
Our behavior.
Yeah, exactly.
Kylie Hamlin is a research psychologist at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And this is The Health Report on ABC Radio National with me, Norman Swan. Babies' brains are highly plastic, meaning they're constantly adapting as they learn and respond to the world and the people around them. It's now known that our brains as adults can change too, but are far less plastic than very young children's. The challenge is to find ways of unlocking this plasticity when it's needed, say if we've had a brain injury. According to other Canadian research, video games may be one way. Daphne Maurer is director of the Visual Development Laboratory at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. She's found clues to when plasticity might be locked off in babies and how in some adults it actually may persist unbeknownst to them.
We're talking about the beginning of development when the brain is getting tuned to the environment in which the child has been born. So the child is learning, my people talk that language, my people look like that, my people eat this kind of food. So the early brain plasticity, the baby's brain starts with an exuberance of connections, is choosing to reinforce those that match the cultural environment. And those that don't match get pruned away. And that's what we call critical periods, periods during which the child must hear language, must have vision, must be exposed to foods, in order for that stabilization to the environment to occur.
So in a sense, they go for everything and then they have to edit.
Exactly. Instead of being born with connections that process exactly what we need to process in our lives, we're born with this process of tuning by experience. But when we talk about brain plasticity, we're talking about something more in the last 5 years, because we have discovered that there are brakes on plasticity. The brain has to work really hard not to be plastic. And that has allowed us to discover ways to renew plasticity in the adult brain.
You think the brain would want to stay plastic. Why does it stop being plastic?
Part of the end of plasticity is a brain that is well matched to the environment of that child.
Lock that all in.
Right. And we now have emerging evidence from animal models that part of what may go wrong in a number of mental and neurological diseases is that these brakes are not put on as strongly as is normal.
And of course, paradoxically, later in life, if something goes wrong, you want that plasticity to come back.
Yes, you want the plasticity. If you have a stroke, if you have a detached retina that's reattached, if something goes wrong with your sensory or cognitive systems. And what we have learned is the brain is still plastic in adulthood. There do seem to be ways to take off the brakes and to restore plasticity in adulthood.
So tell me about the remarkable findings you've made in adults who are blind who get their sight back.
We've studied children who had a period of temporary blindness. So these are children who are born with a very rare condition where they have dense cataracts in both eyes. And what that means is during the first 2 to 3 months of life, until the cataracts are removed surgically and they're given contact lenses, they're getting no experience of beginning to learn the structure of the world. Even though the child with normal eyes, the normal newborn, sleeps most of the time, has really bad vision, can only see large things of high contrast, the children who miss that because of cataracts end up with a long list of seemingly permanent deficits, including lower acuity than normal.
In other words, they can't see as well.
They can't see as well. So we wondered, what could we do when they were 20 to 30 years old and the brain is not supposed to be plastic anymore? And we've had these adults who had seemingly permanent deficits play a first-person shooter game for 40 hours over 4 weeks.
Video games.
Video games. Because there is evidence that adults with normal eyes, when they play an action video game, particularly a first-person shooter, improve their vision. And we tried it with these adults we had followed for 25 years who have seemingly permanent visual deficits. And lo and behold, vision improved, including their visual acuity.
Really?
Really.
So this is from sitting at a video game, firing a gun.
Right. 2 hours a day, 40 hours total, and there was an improvement in vision. Typically, they could read 1 to 2 lines farther down the letter chart. And this was only a 40-hour intervention, so we have no reason to believe that this is the limit of what could be achieved.
What's going on?
That's a really good question. There are really three possibilities, and this is the next stage of the research. One possibility is the brain is actually being rewired, that new connections are being formed. And we know that can happen after stroke, so that's a real possibility. Another possibility is that there were connections there, but they were sub-threshold. They couldn't be activated. And so that what we've done is unmask existing connections. And we know from the literature that can happen. And the third possibility of what's going on in video games is what we called improved efficiency. So a good
You're making the most of what you've got.
Making the most of what you've got, exactly. It's like listening to a radio program where you don't quite have the channel tuned in properly. So you can hear the signal, but there's a lot of static. And maybe what we're teaching these patients to do is to be better at hearing that signal, even though it's so weak and there's so much static.
Does the effect wear off?
We would be really surprised if it wears off because they have better vision, and that vision is going to be reinforced in everyday life.
Now, you've also been studying this in adults with synesthesia. This is fascinating. Describe synesthesia.
In adults with synesthesia, stimulation of one sensory modality, let's say hearing, causes something extra, typically the perception of color. So we say that
some synesthesia...
You hear colors. C-sharp might be vermilion and D-flat might be turquoise. And it can be across any of our sensory systems. So some people taste words. Some people, it's just within one sensory modality. So when they see black letters, they perceive color.
And some people, when they think of numbers, they see them in patterns.
They see them in space. So someone might tell you January is here, February is there, March is behind my back.
That's me.
You have spatial sequence synesthesia.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I envy you. People with synesthesia usually feel sorry for those of us who don't have it. They don't want to be cured. Now, the reason I'm looking at synesthesia is because studies suggest the reason people are synesthetic is that the brain remained in a slightly more infantile state.
Well, you're not the first person to say that.
And what we think happens in synesthesia is that the pruning is incomplete. So I've been looking at synesthesia because it gives me clues to what's going on in the perception of young children. And so far, we've done some tests, and they've all proved to be correct. So one thing that synesthetes who have colored letters report, they pretty much agree that C's are yellow, X's are black, O's are white.
So this is across the board?
Yes. Even though it's a lot of idiosyncrasy, they do agree on certain color letter combinations. And when we test for those in toddlers, they show exactly the same association. So if we say
before the toddlers start to prune, they're synesthetic.
That seems to be the case.
Fascinating.
We've also looked at a characteristic of colored hearing. Again, C-sharp might be vermilion for one synesthete, but turquoise for another synesthete. But they agree that as the pitch gets higher, the colors get lighter. And we tested for that in toddlers. And they agreed. We had two balls going down the screen, one white, one black. There was a higher pitch and a lower pitch. We played a pitch. We said, which ball is making that sound? And they said the higher pitch sound was coming from the white ball and the lower pitch sound was coming from the black ball.
Does this have any practical implications?
It might have implications for education. To the extent that young children's perception is different from adults' perception, some of the ways we teach may be confusing, or more likely there may be things one could use to facilitate learning. For example, presenting C's in yellow. If that seems like a natural combination to young children, they might have an easier time learning that letter of the alphabet if they were taught it first in yellow.
Have you found an age where synesthesia is lost?
Probably never. There is underground synesthesia in all of us. If I ask adults to make connections between pitch and surface lightness, or if I ask them to make connections between letters and colors, our color associations exactly match the toddlers and the synesthetes. So the pruning is incomplete in everyone, not just in synesthetes, but in those of us without synesthesia, it's been sufficient that the synesthesia doesn't get to the conscious perception.
And is there any evidence that adults who are synesthetic have more plastic brains?
That is an excellent question, and we just started testing that in my lab. We are comparing adults with and without synesthesia, seeing if maybe they are better at discriminating between monkey faces. We know that young infants are very good at discriminating between monkey faces. They discriminate them as well as human faces. But by the end of the first year of life, they've gotten better for humans and worse for monkeys. So we're testing them on their ability to discriminate between monkey faces and between non-native speech sounds, predicting that either they'll make the discriminations even as adults, or they'll be easily retrained to make those discriminations.
And you'll just have to wait for the results. Daphne Maurer is Director of the Visual Development Laboratory at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. The University of Oxford in the UK has a world-leading lab investigating brain plasticity. It's run by Professor Heidi Johansson-Berg. They use magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, to look at the brain in action and have studied juggling.
That's right. So we're interested in what happens when healthy people learn new skills or have new experiences. So if we learn a new skill, like playing the piano or juggling, that can change the structure of our brain. So we took people who couldn't juggle and trained them to juggle over a 6-week period. And when we scanned their brains before and after that training, we found that a particular bit of the brain had grown in size, but also that the pathways, the brain fibres that connect that brain area to other areas had changed their properties, had effectively got stronger. And interestingly, those areas that were changing were areas that we know were involved particularly in visual abilities and when people reach for objects in the periphery of space. So exactly those kind of functions that you think should be trained when someone learns to juggle.
So it was both behaving like a muscle and a network.
Exactly. So there's this idea that if you train something repeatedly, it can grow, it can get stronger, but also the special architecture, if you like, of the brain is that it is made up of these vastly complicated networks. What was novel about this study was looking at these connecting pathways, the white matter. So these are the fibres that allow signals to pass between different brain areas and connect up those bits of the networks. And it hadn't previously been shown that those could change their structure.
And the better somebody had learnt juggling, the better the network?
Well, curiously not. So we were expecting to see that by the end of the 6 weeks. So some people could barely do the 3-ball cascade that they were being taught, whereas others could do 5 balls, could do it forwards and backwards and all kinds of fancy tricks. You'd think, therefore, that that variation in skill would relate to the brain structural change, but we didn't actually find that. So one of the things that we're doing now as a follow-up is try and see whether maybe what's more important is simply how long you spend training. So now we're doing a similar study, but people train for different amounts of time.
Because what it might be is that the act of training changes the brain rather than the end result.
Yeah, it might be that the actual learning of the skill might be more related to these fine changes in the strength of connections in the synapses between the cells.
Of course, I mean, that's critical because if you've had a stroke and somebody trains you, you're not going to thank them when they tell you, well, that bit in the brain has got bigger, isn't that fantastic, when you still can't walk.
In the clinical setting, these things are only relevant if they translate into benefit for the patients.
Tell me what you've been doing with people with stroke.
We've been looking to see whether we can use these same imaging techniques to observe what happens in the brain of people as they recover, but also, potentially more excitingly, to see if we can steer that recovery through brain stimulation. We can use very small electrical currents to stimulate people's brains non-invasively. So this is just by placing rubber pads against the scalp and passing a small current, so in the order of 1 to 2 milliamps, between two of these pads, and that has the effect of stimulating the underlying brain tissue. The imaging can tell us which bits would be better to increase, potentially which bits it would be better to decrease, in order to steer the brain along a particular path of recovery.
So where you put the jump lead is important.
Yes.
What problem have you studied in the people with stroke?
So what we've focused on is movement, and particularly hand and arm movement. There are conventional approaches to physiotherapy and motor training that are somewhat effective. What we're trying to do is enhance those effects with brain stimulation. So it's not that we think that the stimulation itself will magically cure these people's brains, but rather that this type of brain stimulation affects the brain in such a way that it makes learning or plasticity more likely to occur. So we know, for example, that it alters certain neurochemicals in the brain in such a way that learning is more likely to occur. So what we typically do is have people undergo a fairly conventional physiotherapy session, a motor training session, but while they're training, while they're practicing their movements, their brain is being stimulated. And the thinking is that therefore the normal changes that would typically happen in their brain happen more strongly or happen more quickly.
And what have you been finding?
The clearest thing is that all patients are benefiting from this intensive physiotherapy. That in itself is actually interesting because these are all patients who are many years post-stroke. And in many cases, the physios are telling us, you know, there's not a great deal of point in working with this person. They're as good as they're going to get. But yet with this 2 weeks of intensive training, they're all getting significantly better. Obviously, the key thing from our perspective is, does the electricity make them get even more better? At this interim stage, there's a small but significant effect. But certainly when you see these patients and how motivated they are to get better, what looks to us on our graph to be a tiny effect for them might make an enormous difference. You know, it might mean that they can eat themselves or that they can tie up their own shoelaces or put on their own shirt.
And you're studying brain stimulation in healthy people to see whether or not it turns them into Einsteins.
That's right. So we've just studied it in a very small way so far, which is that if you have people learn a new motor task, in our case it was a sequence of button presses, they're learning to press these keys in sequence. And just like with the stroke patients, as they're performing that motor learning, we're stimulating their brain in a way that we think will make it more likely for their brain to learn. What we find again is this very subtle effect such that those who are getting stimulated learn that sequence significantly faster. This is kind of exciting. You can think of all sorts of real life situations where that could be applied. You could imagine a class full of children all wired up to their brain stimulation, learning their times tables faster. You can imagine athletes wired up to stimulators learning a new sporting skill more quickly.
Raises all sorts of ethical questions as well.
It certainly does, yes.
Of course, unlike a drug, if they put the electrodes in the wrong place, they might decrease their ability.
Yeah, and certainly that's something that we're acutely aware of in the stroke setting. Because you can have opposite effects of these types of stimulation depending where you place the electrodes, it's really important that we're looking on an individual patient basis as to whether we're making things better or worse. It's also very likely to be the case that the same pattern of stimulation will not be effective for every single stroke patient. Different patients' brains recover in different ways. So what we're trying to move towards is defining a collection of brain scans and tests that we could do when a patient comes into the clinic, and that will tell us what would be the most effective pattern of stimulation for that individual patient.
And you're moving into physical activity.
Yes, that's right. So one of the most effective types of intervention that one can do to improve your brain power is actually to exercise your body. There's very good evidence that particularly as we get older and our brain powers decline, one of the best ways to guard against that is to keep the body active, and in particular to engage in cardiovascular activity, which works the body. So what we're currently doing now is a big study in which we're taking older people who don't typically exercise and enrolling them on an exercise regime where they'll go to the gym a few times a week. And we're scanning their brains and doing lots of tests of their thinking abilities before and after a 3-month period of going to the gym regularly in order to really pin down what those benefits look like and what brain changes seem to be mediating those benefits. We're doing a pilot study in younger people ranging from about 20 to 60. What we're seeing there is that even in that young population, if you take sedentary or inactive people, force them to go to the gym every day, then you can see changes in their brain. So in particular, there's a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which seems to grow in size after that kind of physical training.
Which might affect memory.
Which might affect memory and all kinds of thinking abilities, but particularly memory. And what we see in that population is that that growth of the brain is particularly prominent in the older people. So it seems that there's more scope for this type of physical activity training to affect older brains, which are potentially on a sort of downward decline.
The other aspect of physical activity is emotional and psychological, and people are using it to both prevent and treat depression. And there are parts of the brain not far from the hippocampus that we know are affected by emotion, such as the amygdala. Are you looking at that as well to see whether or not you're actually changing one of the sources of emotion?
Yes, absolutely, because as you say, there's very good evidence that physical activity alleviates depression. So we're assessing depression along with all of our thinking scales. Also, interestingly, in the study on younger people that I mentioned, the particular region within the hippocampus that seemed to be showing the greatest effect is a region which is particularly involved in stress and mood. So it might well be that emotional effects are one of the factors that's mediating the improvements that we see.
Professor Heidi Johansen-Berg heads the Plasticity in Disease Group at the Oxford University Centre for Functional MRI of the Brain. I'm Norman Swan, and this has been the Health Report. Stay tuned, and I'll see you next week.